You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with a Manitowoc teenager who's been throwing birthday parties for kids at the city's homeless shelter for years. The idea has grown into a club of volunteers running food drives, fundraisers, and more. First, President Trump is in Singapore for his much-anticipated meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But at least part of his focus is still on the weekend's tense G7 summit in Canada. Trump argued with his fellow leaders over his planned tariffs on steel and aluminum and what he calls unfair trade practices. The attendees say they're worried about a potential trade war over those tariffs. In particular, Trump called out Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for implementing, quote, massive tariffs, especially on U.S. farmers. Trump also called him very dishonest and weak, saying he was mild-mannered during the meetings, then acted tough in front of the media afterward. Economic advisor Peter Navarro echoed those comments on Fox News Sunday.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door. And that's what bad faith Justin Trudeau did with that stunt press conference. That's what weak, dishonest Justin Trudeau did. And that comes right from Air Force One.
Trump also said the U.S. would not endorse a G7 communique that he had previously agreed to. Our next guest says the global community should have seen a lot of this coming. Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations who specializes on U.S. economic competitiveness. He's also the author of the book Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
Well, before we get into a piece you wrote on this, this weekend was unusually, I guess, zesty when it comes to trade negotiations. What do you make of this aftermath of the G7 meeting?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. I've been watching trade negotiations closely for about 25 years now, and I have never seen anything close to this. I mean, the sort of language that Peter Navarro used to describe the leader of a close allied power, we've all been scratching our heads here to try to see if we can think of any parallels. So it was an extraordinary low point in relations among the countries that, for better or worse, have largely been in charge of managing the global economy for the last 40 or so years. So quite extraordinary.
Now, apart from the language, the core case from the White House seems to be Prime Minister Trudeau was talking one way in this meeting and then came out after and said Canada would do retaliatory tariffs to the steel and aluminum tariffs imposed by the U.S. Is there any case to be made that Trudeau is acting in bad faith there?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think the Canadians have been very consistent on this. They have indicated their preference for a negotiated outcome when the United States went ahead on June 1st and imposed tariffs on Canadian and European as well, Mexican and other steel and aluminum exports. Canada announced quite clearly, quite publicly, along with the EU and Mexico, that it would retaliate against the United States. Canada published its list of the products that are going to be targeted in retaliation a couple of weeks ago. So Prime Minister Trudeau was just reiterating things that he's been saying for some time now. The timing may well have irked President Trump in advance of the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, but the message was absolutely consistent with what the Canadians have been saying for some weeks now.
And you wrote recently that President Trump and candidate Donald Trump has been consistent on the issue of tariffs and trade, and that world leaders, whether the president is right or not, shouldn't have been surprised by his tough tactics.
I mean, there has been an extraordinary consistency of Donald Trump's approach on this issue. He had a tweet that came out today that attacked Germany over its trade surplus with the United States and complained that the U.S. is spending far more on defense and makes much larger contributions to NATO than Germany does. You go back to the mid-1980s when Donald Trump first considered a run for president, he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times and the Boston Globe and the Washington Post saying exactly the same things about the Japanese, saying, why are we paying to defend Japan when Japan is beating us so badly on trade? Look at their big trade surplus. So he has been completely consistent on this. I have some sympathy for leaders in all these countries because it's been hard to move him off of this position at all. They have tried in various ways, but it's not like this was unexpected to anyone who had followed Trump's statements on the issue over the years and during the campaign, where he was also quite explicit.
And you wrote that people may have expected, okay, once he is in office as the president, he'll have cooler heads, maybe advisors around him. He'll see the value as president in having these close relationships, even if trade isn't always perfectly balanced. You say no. In fact, he's become his own trade representative, and he's sticking to where he was 30-plus years ago.
Yeah, I mean, very much the few advisors he had that were resistant, particularly Gary Cohn, his national economic advisor, but also Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and H.R. McMaster, who was his national security advisor, they are all gone now. They are replaced by people who are either more sympathetic to the president's approach on trade or just willing to fall into line, like Larry Kudlow, his new economic advisor. The fact that Peter Navarro is out there on television making those sort of inflammatory comments indicates the change. I mean, Navarro is a trade hardliner, quite anti-China in many respects, has been for years, and he's now being put out in front as a spokesman for the president. So there's been a pretty significant change just over the past several months, which leads me to believe that this is going to get much worse. We may only be at the early stages of the trade conflict here.
Talking to Edward Alden from the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Failure to Adjust: How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Talking about tariffs, trade, and a tough meeting, a G7 meeting in Canada. Does the president have a case that's worth considering? Does the U.S. lose in significant ways in our international trade agreements?
Certainly in some of our trade relationships, there are big problems, to be sure, with China, not just U.S. problems, but problems that all the world has with restrictions in China. The U.S.-Japan trading relationship is not as balanced as it ought to be. I think there are legitimate issues with Mexico. Canada is an odd target because, according to U.S. figures, the United States runs a trade surplus with Canada. So it's hard to kind of single out Canada as an unfair trader. Obviously, dairy access is a big issue there in Wisconsin, but across the board, that's a pretty balanced trading relationship. I do think, you know, Trump has some legitimate concerns. The problem is the way he's going about them. I mean, there have been periods in recent history when the U.S. has expressed concerns over imbalances in the early 1970s, again in the later 1980s during the Reagan administration. And this stuff was worked out with U.S. allies. The very confrontational, aggressive approach that Trump has taken is far out of the norm for our relationships with these countries.
Is this just a tough negotiating tactic? We talk tough, eventually countries will, I don't know, fall into line, give us better deals?
We haven't seen that yet. So, I mean, I think that was clearly the president's hope. There's been a lot of tough talk. It's so far the only country that has kind of fallen into line is South Korea, which agreed to some restrictions on its steel exports to the U.S. and a couple of other things. But it is rather uniquely dependent on the U.S. security guarantee. Every other major trading partner, China, Canada, Mexico, the European Union, has so far refused to fall into line. I think the president's hope is that by actually hitting these countries with tariffs, they will then reconsider. But it forgets politics in other countries. I mean, Justin Trudeau's popularity in Canada is soaring simply because he's standing up to the United States, standing up to Donald Trump, and saying he's going to hit back as hard as the Americans are hitting him. So I think this is backfiring on the president, but I'm afraid he won't see it that way. His response will be to double down and try to increase the threats and the retaliation and hope he can force these countries to heal.
Apart from back-and-forth tariffs between us and our neighbors and the EU and others, is there a concern that countries are going to say, okay, maybe we need to dial back our trade commitments to the U.S., period? Mexico, we've heard, is looking for other sources for pork, for one thing. Do we come out of this and find that, hey, other people have replaced American products with something from elsewhere, and we end up losing out?
I mean, I think there's no case. I think, you know, the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Europeans, the Japanese, every country is making frenetic efforts to do exactly that. You know, of course, President Trump pulled the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership his third day in office. That would have opened up significant new markets for the United States, particularly in agriculture in Japan. That agreement is going ahead without the United States. So there's no question every country that's trading with the United States right now is looking for diversification. It's harder for some countries than for others. I mean, Canada sends about 70% of its exports to the United States. For Mexico, it's nearly 80%. So that is much more difficult for those countries to find new sources, both for their products and also for purchasing the products they currently get from the United States, but they certainly are trying to do that as quickly as they possibly can.
I want to turn to domestic American politics. A lot of people are suspicious of these trade agreements on the left and the right. The Trans-Pacific Partnership seemed almost toxic during the presidential election. Here in the U.S., definitely some communities, some industries have been hurt by international trade. Did we not do enough in the United States to alleviate that, to say, okay, yes, some people are being hurt disproportionately? Is that one of the ways we failed to adjust, to draw from the title of your book?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is absolutely. We didn't do nearly enough as a country. And this was all predictable. I mean, President Kennedy back in 1962, when he created the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, said, look, trade is a policy that's good for the United States as a whole. It's good for our diplomacy, good for our companies, great for us as consumers. We get cheaper, better products. But there are going to be places in the country that are harmed by it, that are open to foreign competition, where factories go out of business, where people lose their jobs. And we need to help those individuals and those communities adjust, get back on their feet, and move forward. We failed miserably at that as a country. If you look at the amount of money we spend on different workforce training programs, we spend about 1/7 the European average. We spend less as a percentage of our economy than any OECD country except for Mexico and Chile. I could give you lots of other examples, but there are lots of parts of the country, including Wisconsin, where we've seen some pretty negative impacts from trade, and little or nothing was done to help those places and those individuals. So it shouldn't be surprising that we've seen this kind of backlash. This is the chickens coming home to roost for decades of neglect from Washington and elsewhere.
In our last minute or so, we know where the president is on this issue. Do you see a role for Congress in trying to maybe step in and de-escalate a spiraling trade war?
I mean, there's no question there should be. Under the Constitution, foreign commerce is clearly under the authority of Congress. Congress has the power to pull back the president on this issue. But so far, the Republican leadership has made it very clear it has no intention of doing that. And even if the Democrats take the House and or the Senate in November, I don't see the Democrats doing that. I mean, generally, you know, as you suggested in your earlier question, the Democrats have been very skeptical of trade, including the TPP and NAFTA and other deals. So I think the president is going to continue to have a lot of room to run, and other countries and we here in the United States are going to have to deal with the consequences of that.
Briefly, you sound worried.
I'm very worried. I think we are on the brink of potentially a seriously damaging trade war, which could harm not only economies around the world, but longstanding alliance relationships. So, you know, in my sort of 30-year career of doing this stuff, I've never been as worried as I am right at the moment.
Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob.
That's Edward Alden, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness. He's the author of the book Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. We talked to him about this weekend's G7 summit in Canada, trade, tariffs, and what could happen next. A birthday can be one of the most exciting days of the year for a kid. But for families dealing with homelessness, coming up with gifts or a party can be a tall order. That's where our next guest saw an opportunity to try and help people out. She started throwing birthday parties for children at Manitowoc's Hope House shelter when she was just in second grade. Now she's ready to start high school, and with the help of a few hundred other volunteers, she plans to keep the celebrations going and a whole lot more. Leah Hale is the founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club in Manitowoc. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, where did you first get this idea of throwing birthday parties for homeless children in Manitowoc?
So when I was 9 years old, my mom and I went to Hope House to drop off some donations that my Girl Scout troop had previously collected. And so that day we actually met a little boy who saw all the bags that we were carrying were for him because it was his birthday. So then I asked the director if he was having a party, and she said no, that they didn't have any programs in place at that time that provided birthday parties for the kids. So I just felt terrible and felt like we should do something for him. So then I was talking to my parents and asked them if we could give him a party. So we ended up talking to the director, and then later that same day, she thought it was a great idea. So next day we showed up with cake and some balloons and a small gift, and that's how the club got started.
So, yeah, that was your first one at 9 years old. What happened next?
After that, it just kind of started to grow. We branched out from birthday parties to then special events and holiday dinners.
And how do you have any idea how many parties you've thrown since then?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea. Probably well over 100. There's not a lot of birthday parties each month, but usually only like one or two. But definitely a lot.
And when you throw a party, I understand you try to make sure it's what the kid would want. So you talk to the boy or girl, and why do you want to tailor it to their interests?
I think it's just important because the kid's birthday party is so centered around them, and just kind of that's their day where they just get to have fun and kind of be a kid and not worry about the situation that they're in. So I guess it kind of gives it more of a meaning if it's more of tailored to them and has like the theme that they... or something that they really enjoy instead of just like a generic like cake and balloons.
What kind of themes have you done at these parties?
We did PJ Masks, which is super popular right now. We also have done, we had a kid that liked wrestling and dinosaurs, so then we've had it where we've combined like the two themes, so we've had our one and only wrestling dinosaur party. And then a lot of times the party trends just seem to go with whatever in the movie theaters, like Star Wars or Avengers.
And I'm guessing you've done a Frozen party or two?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And what kind of reactions do you get from the kids and maybe even their parents?
I just, a lot of times, it kind of just depends on the family. Some families are very, like, they're very, like, outward with expressing, you know, like, gratitude or whatnot, but some of them prefer to keep it more private and kind of keep to themselves more. But the general reaction is they're very thankful and very happy for the party that was provided for their kid.
And it's not just a one-person show anymore. It sounds like you've gotten other people in the community involved. How are people helping out?
Well, we have over 900 members now, and we also have the local businesses like Cops and Party Pizzazz that do a lot of the help with the donations and drives.
So those are members of the Hopeful Hearts Club. When did you turn this into the Hopeful Hearts Club and make it, you know, more than just you throwing parties?
I actually started talking to my second grade classroom about it at the time, and they thought it was really cool. So then I had, like, the first members there, and then I think just from there talking about it more, and once the community got to know about it, it was a lot more people wanted to join and donate and see what they could do, so... we just decided that it would be best if everybody could be involved in some way.
And you mentioned you're doing birthday parties, but you're also doing other events. What all is the Hopeful Hearts Club doing now?
Well, our annual picnic is coming up in June. We also provide baby showers and like holiday dinners for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then we have our like drives, like the school supply drive or a food drive. And then sometimes we'll do, like, tailgating parties.
And talk about, you know, you've gotten a lot of people involved. You said 900 members. What do they say to you? Are they getting something out of this, too?
My club would not be what it is right now without the members and their support and generosity. And I definitely think that any volunteer, any person that does give back will say that they do feel very happy because, you know, like, you're not only, like, giving to a person, but you're kind of giving for yourself because it does make you feel really good and make you want to keep doing what you're doing.
Talking to Leah Hale, founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club in Manitowoc, about her work with homeless kids in that community and spreading the word, too. Leah, how do you, you're a busy student, I'm sure, how do you find the time to do all of this?
Lots of organization and lists.
And is this something you want to keep doing through high school now that you're going into school and maybe even beyond?
Yes, definitely. I plan to do it for as long as possible.
And for people listening in other parts of the state thinking, oh, you know, this is something that sounds great. I'd love to make a difference, but what do I know? I don't know how to do this. How would you encourage them to try to do something similar in other parts of the state?
It's just you don't even have to do, like, any huge thing. It's just starting small, like maybe... even going to your local homeless shelter and, you know, providing, like, canned goods or going to, like, a food pantry and donating food there or even just, like, tutoring children for, like, schools, you know. It's not it's one of those things where it's, like, if you start small, it could definitely grow from there and get the ripple effect.
And maybe people in schools, like, I mean, you were in elementary school when you started this. Kids in school might not even be thinking about trying to do something to help people in their community. It might just not be on their radar. Why is this important to you for kids in particular and teens to be involved?
I think just because it, a lot of times, in order to spread generosity in the world, it starts with the younger generation. So I think if we could instill that in younger kids and teens now, then it will definitely help when they grow into adults to be more kind and generous and just have a better working society.
I don't know if you ever encounter this in the world or on social media or whatever. Have you ever run into, you know, when people say, oh, what's wrong with kids these days? Do you ever hear that and think, well, actually, we're doing some pretty good stuff here?
Yeah, so a lot of times I do. It's kind of like one of those things where people, I feel, focus more on the negative. But I know there are a lot of decent kids out there that really are kind people and want to do good in the world.
And Leah, before I let you go, you mentioned that the Hope House picnic is coming up. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, they're having their June picnic this Saturday, and then it's just basically a cookout, and then the families just get to kind of hang out for the day, and then we're doing have some outdoor activities planned for them too. So,
Leah, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and thanks for talking to us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Leah Hale is the founder of the Hopeful Hearts Club in Manitowoc. She's been throwing birthday parties and doing a lot more for children at the city's Hope House shelter since she was in just second grade. Now, a panel convened by President Trump after the mass shooting at a Florida high school is apparently not considering the role of guns in school violence. U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos was asked about the commission by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy during a hearing last week.
Will your commission look at the role of firearms as it relates to gun violence in our schools?
That is not part of the commission's charge, per se.
I see. So you, so you're studying gun violence, but not considering the role of guns.
We're actually studying school safety and how we can ensure our students are safe
at school.
According to the Department of Education's website, the point of the Federal Commission on School Safety, which is led by DeVos, is to come up with recommendations to improve safety, and that includes a discussion on the minimum age for firearms purchases. DeVos said in her testimony that the commission would look into violent video games, movies, and other entertainment, as well as media coverage of mass shootings. It's expected to deliver a set of proposals by the end of the year. Ron Avi Astor has been studying school shootings. He's a professor of school behavioral health at the University of Southern California. He's the author of books including Mapping and Monitoring Bullying and Violence, Building a Safe School Climate, and Welcoming Practices, Creating Schools that Support Students and Families in Transition. He wrote an opinion piece for CNN after the Parkland, Florida shooting titled Seven Ways to Help Prevent School Shootings. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First off, what's your reaction to that exchange with Secretary DeVos saying her panel isn't looking into the role of guns in school shootings?
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny that you need me for a reaction because it's so obvious. The reason why this panel is being pulled together in this commission is, you know, because of the Florida shooting, because of the Texas shootings, and because of these shootings for the past 20 years, and to not cover gun violence. I don't know. I think everybody is scratching their head right now.
One part that she didn't talk about there, as I mentioned, the commission is, their charge is to study the age at which people can buy guns. Under federal law, you have to be 21 to buy from a licensed dealer. You can be 18 from a private unlicensed seller. That's handguns, I believe. Does the age, the minimum age of purchase of firearms, is that an important part of the story here?
Yes, I think when you, particularly from the Never Again movement started from the students at Parkland after the shooting, I think that's become one of the major bullet points in terms of trying to reduce the overall numbers of shootings and people who die in the United States due to firearms. But specifically within her domain, within schools, I think what's disingenuous about the stance in her comment to the senator is the fact that we know through the Center for Disease Control, through the California Healthy Kids Survey, and other surveys in other states, that there are guns and lots of other weapons already on campus. That's been collected for decades, and to not have that as part of the strategy is very problematic. In fact, I'll give you an example in California. Over the last 15, 20 years, every year they collect this data and they ask kids in middle schools and high schools, and you have for the whole state, they cover every school, between 20 and 30% of the kids in specific schools across the state and statewide average say that they've actually seen a weapon on school grounds. A lot of them have seen guns on school grounds. To ignore that data and to not actually listen to what the kids are saying is really going against the public health approach. It would say the kids know that they're on school grounds. What can we do to those specific schools to help them? So I think it's shocking, you know, that that's not part of it. I think the whole idea of weapons on school grounds, if you think about students functioning, not just school shootings, but let's just say going to algebra or math class or reading, and the idea that they've seen a weapon on school grounds and how are they supposed to function afterwards, that should be part of what the commission talks about as well, too. And then finally, if she is concerned about weapon use, I mean, then many advances, particularly by the University of Virginia, Dewey Cornell's work, and in other states where they've done very thoughtful threat assessment methods that use students, faculty, and others, and that really involves weapon use. So, again, I could go on and how difficult that statement is, but the data is showing us that just looking at the age 19 really is not fully within her domain. That's more in the domain of different agencies. There's a lot that she could be doing with the Department of Ed to be looking at issues of weapons and how that's affecting students on school grounds.
Talking to Ron Avi Astor from the University of Southern California about school safety, preventing shootings at schools. Ron, you alluded to this a bit, and we mentioned that piece you wrote for CNN after the Parkland shooting. You gave a variety of recommendations, and one of them was trying to keep students, teachers, other staff involved in violence prevention, and the idea that if we can listen to them at the ground level, not to wait for an anonymous call, say, to the FBI to filter through channels and then come back to the school, we can make a big difference. Talk about what you'd like to see.
Well, it really builds on the early comment that I just said, is that, you know, there's a canary in the mine. The students know the rumbling before the earthquake. So what we find in all these situations regarding shootings, I might add suicides as well, is that a very large percentage of the peer group on school grounds appears to have knowledge of some sort of a weapon being on school grounds, of threats being made, or even of their friends thinking of suicide and having a method or a weapon. And that's really untapped in terms of knowing how to access that information and that intel in order to save the lives of kids or to get kids in schools to be thinking that they're actually saving their friends' lives. And what we've done in 145 schools in California is actually try and, rather than harden the schools and bring police officers and dogs and metal detectors and the militaristic kinds of security measures, which are intuitively make common sense to some people, we went the opposite way and softened those schools. In other words, really focused on strengthening those relationships between the teachers and kids, between the students and each other, building trust, and actually framing it that, you know, you could save your friend's life with this knowledge, and this is how you could do it. It's not snitching, it's really supporting them. And there you could see not only are the kids doing better academically, not only do they feel more connected to their school, not only does the school climate get better, but when you look at, for example, the issue of carrying a gun on school grounds, over a 8-year period, we saw a 55% reduction in those schools. That wasn't necessarily just targeting weapons at that point. It was about the relationships with knives. We never talk about knives, clubs, or other kinds of weapons. We saw almost a 40% reduction. For that 30% that saw weapons on school grounds, we had a 40% reduction in students seeing and hearing about weapons. And then you wouldn't think, but we had a 44% reduction in gang affiliation participation. And we think that's because the school could also be a place of safe haven for these kids in very difficult situations or situations where there's community crime. And these kinds of ways of softening the school could actually be the best way we know to actually reduce weapon use on school grounds.
Why do you think we're not having a conversation about what you're talking about, this threat assessment, this building community with students and teachers, as opposed to what you're saying, the hardening of the schools, armed whoever, police, armed teachers, one entrance, lots of locks, that kind of thing? Why does that seem more attractive to talk about?
It's a really good question. And the scientists for the last organizing pre-Sandy Hook and more strongly after Sandy Hook are scratching our heads on why, again, the national media is not listening to the scientific results in terms of what works. Instead, we see that most of the media reporting and policy is coming from the law enforcement perspective and, quite frankly, industry folks who are selling specific security measures and ideas and security guards. The vast majority of research, and there's a mountain of it, showing that the more you harden the schools, the more you bring these kinds of what they used to call zero tolerance measures into schools, even though initially people feel good about that, over the long run, you see massive dropout, non-attendance. You see the school-to-prison pipeline growing. The Texas data is amazing in terms of going in that direction, and kids actually going to prison at earlier ages. So the side effects of that are large, and I think some of us stop and say, is this what we want our society to be? Is this what we want our schools to look like? And I'm not sure why the data, and again, there are thousands, maybe 20,000 studies in the recent years on issues of school climate and bullying, all showing that by softening, by having this integration that I talked about earlier of the academics and the social, emotional, and the climate, it's a win-win situation across the board, including gang and weapon reduction. So we do need to have a louder voice as scientists. We're trying. We're trying very hard. But I think there's just an intuitive reaction response that, you know, we just need to have guns to fight guns, or we need more police officers. The analogy I like to people that I think is maybe more comprehensible is when you think of your own community, for example, where you want to live with your house. You know, if you had a police officer in every corner and a bunch of tanks in the neighborhood, that doesn't necessarily make you feel safer or more comfortable. What we look for with a house are people gardening, kids riding their bikes on the streets, neighbors speaking to each other, relationships that are strong. Those are the kinds of places where we enjoy living, where we want to raise our kids.
We're talking with Ron Avi Astor, professor of school behavioral health at the University of Southern California, talking about school safety and efforts to prevent mass shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see this federal commission investigate the role of guns in school shootings, or are guns not the issue? What do you think of our guest's ideas, the research he's talking about? Instead of hardening schools, making them more and more secure physically, building trust, building relationships between teachers and students. He says a lot of research says that's bringing down the number of weapons in schools. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Ron Avi Astor is with us from the University of Southern California. We're looking at school safety. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos told the Senate subcommittee last week that President Trump's School Safety Commission was not investigating the role of guns in school shootings. To your calls we go. Steve is with us in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi, Rob. First of all, I think you do a great job, and thanks for all you do. I really agree 100% with what your guest is saying, and it kind of begs the question, what's next? The Department of Health and Human Services releases a statement saying we're going to look at drug addiction, but we're not going to look at the role of opioids in drug addiction. I mean, to me, that's an apt analogy. I think what we really need are to restore school social workers and counselors to our schools. There have been just a lot of cuts over the last 8 years in those ancillary services.
Steve, thanks. I want to bring Ron in on this. Steve saying, definitely talk about guns, he says, but also more social workers in the schools.
Right. Social workers, psychologists, counselors, nurses. We know that those are very helpful, particularly for students that have distress or difficult situations. If they're on school grounds and there are issues, those kinds of professionals are specifically trained to help those teachers and students and principals to work. So absolutely, we see that that makes a big difference.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Stan in Franklin. Stan, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I'll be real quick. You know, the parents factored in here. I mean, we're talking about schools, teachers, social workers. I mean, the parents, plural, or parents, singular, that's where these children come from when they start their day, their homes. My goodness, let's have the schools, let's have the communities try to put the energy into reaching out to these homes, parents, but flyers or what have you to address, you know, to be sure that their homes are an environment that these kids, these children don't have access.
Stan, we're just about out of time. I want to give Ron a chance to weigh in. The role of parents in all of this, Ron.
Absolutely very important. Don't disagree. But what we found in our research around the world is that if the school is set up to be caring and supportive, as I described earlier, that even if the parents are having great difficulties, they may have drug addictions, they may have other kinds of issues, and those kids attend really amazing good schools, they actually do not end up becoming gang members or bullies or have other issues. The school can help compensate quite a bit, more than we ever thought, particularly in those days. Obviously, we need to get the parents involved too, but sometimes you can't. And these amazing schools could be transformative for kids' lives. So it's not an either-or. We need to do both, but let's focus on the schools because there we have quite a bit of control.
Briefly, we're just about out of time, Ron. One thing you say is important is when there's been a kid, they've been found with a weapon, maybe they're expelled or in an alternate school, you say we need to keep working with that kid.
Absolutely, and not just send them out or kick them out to alternative schools. Again, the threat assessment method done by Duke Cornell in Virginia is amazing. They have data from two states on it already showing that they've been able to prevent, and there's been no shootings, no incidents happening, by just having this more thoughtful, caring, supportive approach that follows the kids, uses social workers, counselors, but also the teachers, the peer group, parents, community, kind of wrap around these kids. And treat it as a resource, things that these kids need, then follow them over time. That's a much stronger approach than just kicking them out, not knowing what's happening afterwards, or putting them in an alternative school that's not connected and they just are kicked down the road in that kind of sense.
We'll leave it there for now. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ron Aviaster, professor of school behavioral health at the University of Southern California. He's also the author of the book Mapping and Monitoring Bullying and Violence, Building a Safe School Climate. We talked to him about school safety and President Trump's school safety committee saying they're not looking into the role of guns in school shootings.